Here we are at the end of the month, and you have arrived at the Takeaway Podcast for June 30th, 2015.
I want to be sincere. Is it because they want to get rid of us? They are not going to do that. I will explain to you. The cost will be huge.
That's Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras speaking live on state television Monday evening about the last chance for a deal to keep Greece in the euro system. But Greece, the pearl of the Aegean Sea, is officially financially underwater. It owes more than 170% of its GDP. Greece owes one of its creditors, the International Monetary Fund, a repayment of $1.7 billion today, a payment that the country says it can't make. Will Greece go bankrupt, leave the European Union, or come to an agreement with its lenders in the upcoming July 5th referendum? We've been asking different forms of this question for months. Daniel Altman is senior editor of Foreign Policy Magazine and professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. He's also a former economic advisor to the British government. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Is this a different question today? Does the referendum really change the whole picture?
Well, it's interesting. The prime minister actually said that the referendum was for him part of the negotiating process rather than something to change the picture or be definitive. So he sees it as just one more phase and was likely to be a very drawn-out process even now. Whether or not Greece defaults, whether or not Greece leaves the euro, there will be claims disputed with their creditors for years to come.
And while some can say this is democracy in action in the land where democracy was invented, it could also be said that this is a failure of leadership. I mean, Tsipras is basically telling the folks in Greece who've been suffering for 2 years to hang themselves.
I think the problem for him is that he can say to the people that he's been trying time after time to get a better deal, and the European Union, the European Central Bank, the International Monetary Fund really haven't budged that much in the last few months on what they're prepared to offer. So it's a frustrating situation because it seems like he's been a failure, and he seems like he's using his last resort by calling this referendum. That, you know, if he's not able to make progress, then he'll let the people make the final decision. So he looks ineffectual, but it's not clear that he could have gotten that much more out of his creditors and the others.
The Greek people won't have the option of wording the resolution in the referendum on July 5th. But is there any message that could come out of this referendum that would say to the big players in the eurozone, come on, give us a break here. We need to do some debt relief to realistically solve this problem.
The problem for me really is that so much may change in the next week before we even see the referendum, or the next several days, I should say, that the question may turn out to be irrelevant. I mean, we may see some movement on either side that would mean a different deal is actually being the one proposed rather than the one that should be the question in the referendum. We may see a complete collapse in terms of these negotiations, and that could lead to the beginning of an exit from the euro. It could lead to defaults of various kinds that would make parts of that deal potentially irrelevant or untenable. And so it's very hard to know right now what the situation will be and how relevant the question will be.
Let's just stipulate for the moment that the Greeks have behaved badly and that there has been problems with a lack of austerity in its budgets. Is it also the case that the Germans and the French have used the IMF to maintain this pretense that there isn't a two-tiered system in the euro, at least a two-tiered system?
Well, this goes back to some of the fundamental problems with the euro. The euro was set up as a common currency for all these countries that had very disparate economic cycles. And you can't make monetary policy if some countries are booming while other countries are in recession. You don't know whether rates should be high or low. And Greece was sort of shunted into the euro quite early in its period of life, so at 2 years after the official launch, more or less, in a way that ignored many of the fundamental problems with Greece's fiscal situation. In fact, Greece sort of fudged the numbers and people kind of looked the other way, allowing Greece to come in more as a political imperative than as an economic one. So this two-tiered system has always existed because there have been countries like Greece that have been unsuited to this currency union who have been in there for quite a while now, and it was almost inevitable that one of them would enter this kind of crisis.
Before we go, is there any way to think of the eurozone leadership as a stimulus economic planning function where they would actually try to encourage the Greek economy to grow as opposed to punishing it moralistically about bad behavior of the past?
Well, that would be a complete about-face, and yet that might be one of the only things that could really resolve this situation. If they started to realize that Greece has long-term problems with things like corruption and tax collections that need long-term solutions, that need cultural solutions as well as economic solutions, and short-term deals to try and make them tighten their belts enough to start chipping away at their debt are not going to solve those problems.
Well, we'll certainly be talking about this again. Daniel Altman is senior editor of Foreign Policy Magazine and professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. He's also a former economic advisor to the British government. Daniel, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
While the EU works through its Greece problem, the U.S. has a Puerto Rico problem to the tune of $70 billion. Garcia Padilla, the governor of Puerto Rico, says that's how much of the Commonwealth debts that are, quote, not payable. Some of that debt is owed to the U.S. government, some is owed to private investors. The problem is that Puerto Rico isn't allowed to file for bankruptcy, which means the government might have to negotiate some kind of agreement with its creditors. For more, we turn to Justin Velazhagen, who's founder of the National Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John, for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Would bankruptcy help in this case?
I do believe so. There's a number of reasons for it. One is if they're in a situation where they need to do some sort of restructuring, the way things are set up as is, it's going to be a free-for-all where it's going to be a negotiation between debtors and the debtees and debtors. And right now there's no oversight to that negotiation process. So it's a difficult process that could be a little bit crazy, if you will, a lot of bluffing going on, a lot of hardballing, if you will. And everyone's going to want what they want and not necessarily get what they want. And if you have a restructuring process that is overseen by a judicial system, similar to a Chapter 9 bankruptcy situation for municipal governments, then you have a judge-ordered bankruptcy, and it's overseen by the judicial system, so it's a lot more organized. And I think that'll be the fairest process. The only problem is, of course, Puerto Rico is not allowed to go through that process right now.
And how did Puerto Rico get in this situation?
Well, they got here. There's a number of reasons, but really it came down to legislators in Puerto Rico who were offering a lot of benefits to the people, and obviously they want to get elected, they want to get reelected, healthcare promises, benefits of jobs, certain benefits of employment through the government that they had promised to offer and promised to maintain, and they were able to do that because there's a lot of lenders throughout the rest of the continental U.S., especially who are willing to lend money to Puerto Rico by buying their bonds. Bonds are really attractive in Puerto Rico for a few reasons. Number one, they're triple tax exempt, which a lot of people don't realize. But on top of that, they also have higher than usual yields. So returns to investors are higher than most municipal bonds around the country. So investors looking to invest in it and possibly make a buck, especially speculators, especially hedge funds, especially those with a little bit higher risk tolerance, were constantly willing to give the funds to the Puerto Rican government that they wanted to use to spend, to invest in infrastructure, to invest in benefits, to invest in a lot of the services that they had promised and the people wanted. And it's kind of been a continuing cycle. There's been a lot of speculators have said, okay, they're paying it back. Somehow they're finding a way. At some point, everyone's seen for years that at some point there's going to be a problem. It's going to come to a head. But everyone's kind of gambled on the fact that it's not going to be today. It's not going to be my money. I can keep rolling over my funds, keep investing in Puerto Rico, keep lending them money because as of right now, it looks decent. At least that's what they've said in the past. It's really been a political reason that they've constantly been both asking for and spending more money to kind of maintain the positions that they promised.
Is part of the gamble here that lenders have thought that at some point the federal government was going to bail Puerto Rico out because it is a U.S. territory? Is that part of the sales pitch from Puerto Rico, buy these bonds because wink, wink, nod, nod, we know they're backed by the U.S. government?
I don't think so. I think it's almost been the opposite, where lenders have said, okay, Puerto Rico doesn't really have that backstop of the U.S. They also don't have the possibility for bankruptcy, so they more or less have more leverage in the negotiation process. If Puerto Rico wants to continue spending money, where are they going to get it? They have to get it from lenders, and lenders will come together and say, okay, Puerto Rico, you want more of our money, here's what you have to do. So it's been almost a one-sided negotiation process from once they got to a point where Puerto Rico was more or less desperate to have more funds and continue to fund them. So just because of that leverage that was one-sided, lenders said, hey, you know, it looks like an attractive process until Puerto Rico gets to the point where they really are not bluffing and they have to do something, some sort of restructuring or renegotiation, or they won't be able to pay.
In a serious austerity situation, who's going to suffer first in Puerto Rico?
The people, the islanders. It's going to be they have a high percentage of their population that's employed by the Puerto Rican government. It's higher than usual around the country. So once they start to make these more austere cuts and start to make cuts to government spending, you're going to see not only the more layoffs, more cutbacks, more employment cutbacks, but also to benefits. There's a huge health care benefit shortage in Puerto Rico right now financially. That'll probably increase. The shortage will increase. And they're already feeling the pain. They have 14% unemployment. And frankly, I think that's a huge underestimate of the real unemployment, given the informal economy as well. And they're going to be hit the hardest, of course.
And as far as solutions are concerned, how could this come down?
I think first and foremost, if the U.S. mainland federal administrators and Congress really want to keep the taxpayers out of it, probably the best solution is really a court overseen restructuring to Chapter 9 bankruptcy. I think would be the best way to start. From there, it's going to be like pulling off the Band-Aid. It's going to be a really strong jolt to the economy of Puerto Rico, as administrators are going to have to do what they haven't wanted to do for years. And they're going to have to make some significant austere cuts. It's going to hurt for a while, but in the long run, it's what has to be done.
Justin Velez-Hagan is founder of the National Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce. Justin, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
In the immediate aftermath of the mass shooting in Charleston, the House Appropriations Committee once again quietly rejected an amendment that would have allowed the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to study the underlying causes of gun violence as a public health issue. It can be traced back much further to 1996, when the CDC was first accused by the National Rifle Association of funding science to promote gun control. The NRA went after researchers like Professor Fred Rivera at the University of Washington.
And as a result of that, many, many people stopped doing gun research. The number of publications on firearm violence decreased dramatically. It was really chilling in terms of our ability to conduct research on this very important problem.
That's Dr. Fred Rivera speaking about the NRA's pushback and its effect on him on The Takeaway back in April. The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins me now. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So you really showed us how the shooting bears no sort of relevance to the issue of gun violence at John Boehner's news conference last week, which was right in the aftermath of the shooting. I mean, you put the question directly to John Boehner.
I did, because the aftermath of the Charleston shooting in so many ways is similar to the aftermath of the shooting in Newtown at Sandy Hook Elementary. And I asked the Speaker of the House this very question. Mr. Speaker, in 2013, 34,000 Americans died from gunshot wounds. The House Appropriations Committee approved a bill that continues the blocking, the essential blocking, effectively, of gun research, health research at the Centers for Disease Control. Is it an appropriate time to continue that prohibition? Here is his answer.
Listen, the CDC is there to look at diseases that need to be dealt with to protect the public health. I'm sorry, but a gun is not a disease. And guns don't kill people. People do. And when people use weapons in a horrible way, we should condemn the actions of the individual and not blame the action on some weapon.
Now, is Boehner correct there in saying that the CDC's research blames the public health issue on the weapons themselves?
The original concern and accusation from the National Rifle Association back in 1996 that you heard Dr. Rivera talk about made that very implication. The NRA complained to Congress that the CDC was using the results of its research essentially to advocate for gun control. They called it propaganda. Back at that time, then, Congress slashed CDC's funding by the exact amount that was used for gun public health research. And it doesn't technically ban CDC from doing that research now. However, John, the CDC took that as a direct threat, and so did researchers. That's what Fred Rivera was talking about there. So ever since, the CDC has been basically cowed away from doing this research. Now, there is other research that goes on at the CDC, we should say, that does have to do with guns. There's a National Violent Death Reporting System that does record causes of all violent deaths, including in domestic abuse, youth violence, child abuse, abuse. And if gun is the cause, that's recorded. It's not like they ignore it entirely. But guns, gun deaths and gun injuries as a public health issue, as Rivara said, are still basically anathema to CDC researchers and to anyone who gets CDC funding, which is potentially millions of dollars.
So if you're over at the CDC right now, if you're a researcher, if you're a young public health professional and you grew up in a city like Chicago and see the proliferation of guns and the proliferation of violence, if you even suggest that you want to study this as a public health matter, your career is kind of over.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know that your career would end if you made the suggestion. But here's the problem that you hear out of a lot of federally funded researchers. They're very concerned about how the interpretation of their data might be used, because the congressional prohibition, which was extended in this very vote that we're talking about in that appropriations bill, prevents the CDC from advocating any form of gun control. And what researchers are concerned about is that if they report the results of their data publicly and say, for instance, as Fred Rivara found in the 90s, that having a gun in the home makes you more likely to be injured than if you don't have a gun in the home, that you'll be accused by Congress of breaking the rules and advocating for gun control.
And that's against the congressional rules, and it's essentially illegal to even ask the question. Something
it's
like
illegal
that?
It's illegal to answer the question, essentially.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, on the strange mythology of Capitol Hill. Thanks as always, Todd.
You got it, Sean.
In the dark times of old, the world was engulfed in foulness and decay. The waters receded, the bitter rains fell. Civilization was powerless in the face of steadily rising temperatures. Lands and cities that had thrived for hundreds of years vanished without a trace. In those times, a story was told of a man of God from the south.
You have only one choice.
Who, together with the imams of the north and the rabbis and sages from the east and west, stopped the wars, united the tribes of earth, and together they saved the planet.
And then you see it.
See what?
White shore. A far green country into a swift sunrise.
This Lord of the Ringsy kind of story could be how it turns out. Centuries from now, history may speak of a legend about the churches leading the way to reverse climate change. Our series, God's Plan, Faith Communities Mobilize on the Environment, examines how organized religion is uniting with science to encourage social change to save the planet. Pope Francis's encyclical on care for our common home last week, addressing the moral impact of climate change, marked a bold moment for the Catholic Church. And all this week, we're looking at the places where religious doctrine and environmentalism intersect, and how different faith leaders are addressing questions of climate change and the use of natural resources. Catherine Jefford Shorey is the former presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. She says churches and church leaders have more of a voice today in shaping the discussion and acceptance of scientific facts than they did two decades ago.
The Episcopal Church understands climate change as real. Scientific evidence has been pretty clear about this for a couple of decades, actually. The Episcopal Church is urgently concerned because of the care of the earth is a central part of what we believe it means to be in right relationship with God and our neighbors. There are some Episcopal churches that have begun to observe a liturgical season of prayer for creation, usually in the range of September and October.
There have been political conservatives who have said the Pope should leave science to the scientists and mind his own business on some level. Would you say that the church is capable of advocating for radical change, or do secular authorities typically not pay much attention to the church's views on matters like this?
I actually think that the churches generally have a larger voice than they did 20 years ago. There's much greater interest in the civic environment for participation of people of faith. And it's not just churches, obviously. It's mosques and Jewish organizations and Sikhs and Hindus. People whose perspective on the world and reality charges them to consider the needs of their neighbors, to care for their neighbors as they would for themselves. That's what's going to be most centrally impactful in the response to climate change.
Bishop, the Pope mentioned, and I'll quote some lines here, that scientists are to be praised for getting to the bottom of climate change, of understanding the human causes as he describes them, and that scientists are to be praised for pointing towards solutions to this, possibly, particularly in the domain of access to water and availability of clean water for all of the people of the world. Would you say that represents a different kind of embrace of science than we're traditionally used to from the Vatican?
I don't have a great deal to compare that with. My sense is that the Vatican has supported scientific inquiry for a long time. It's not been well known. There's an observatory at the Vatican, for example, that does some very interesting cosmological and interstellar work. Many people remember that the Vatican had a negative opinion of Galileo and Copernicus way back when. But science is a way of knowing about the world, and the faith tradition is as well. They take somewhat different attitudes and they ask different questions, but there's no reason at all why they shouldn't be working together. This encyclical is expected to point to the connections between the way human beings treat the rest of creation and the impacts of their treatment on both human beings and other members of creation. And it's the poorest who are least able to respond to issues of climate change and environmental destruction. And it is therefore the responsibility of people who have greater access to social resources and to power in the world to care for those who are least able to respond. Our use of air sheds and water sheds is reducing the ability of people to grow food across the world. It's forcing children to grow up in polluted environments. It's impacting the health of people everywhere. And the only way we're going to address that is by working together across religious traditions, across social communities, and globally.
Catherine Jefford Shorey was the first woman to serve as presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, a position she held for 9 years until this past weekend. The church elected its first black presiding bishop, the Right Reverend Michael Bruce Curry, bishop of the Diocese of North Carolina. As we follow this topic all week, head over to thetakeaway.org for full coverage in a series we're calling God's Plan, Faith Communities Mobilize on the Environment. All musicians are collectors of sound. A musician finds a riff.
I'm dazed and confused, hanging on by a thread.
It becomes a song in their own style, blues to rock.
Been dazed and confused for so long, it's not true.
Led Zeppelin, Collectors of the Blues. Who did the original version of that classic song, God Rest You Merry Gentlemen? Who cares?
God rest you merry gentlemen.
Let nothing you dismay.
For Jesus Christ our Savior
was born on Christmas Day.
Sam Lee is a musician and a one-of-a-kind collector of song and sound. You can imagine him much like a bird watcher in a remote woodland, carefully stepping through traditional English, Irish, Scottish, and gypsy melodies. He takes what he wants and makes something else, something beautiful, that comes straight from his gentle heart. Sam Lee's new album, The Fade in Time, is now available in the U.S., and he gave us a chance to hear how he does it, from the first note he hears to the music itself, he says, tells him to stop.
The music is the traditional songs that we thought had disappeared, but they still exist, mostly amongst the gypsies and the travellers who live a very kind of outward, off-the-radar existence. They live in caravans and in trailer parks and houses in cul-de-sacs that nobody else would go and live in, and hidden themselves away from society because society doesn't really want to know about them. And amongst them and amongst their elders have kept these magnificent old songs and stories.
You are at the Moss House, where the birds did increase, at the foot of Mount Leinster, oh, some silent plain.
I'm more like a forager out in the fields gathering the wasted, the unwanted, the weeds, the detritus, the trash, the scrap. I'm there gathering it all and polishing it up, making it beautiful, cooking it, stewing it, yeah, flavouring it. Often I'll be driving down the street. I'll be looking through the hedgerows, through the fences, trying to spot that flash of white trailer parks. And I'll pull the car over, and it's them that I'm seeking out, the ones with the old memories.
I wish I had you in Phoenix Island, 1,000 miles from my native home.
There's a kind of collapsing of time that happens. There's a moment where a concertinaing, like the ancient world, suddenly rushes forward. I'm not travelling back in time by any means. It's very much about the now. But there's this moment where they, if they do recognise a song, and maybe they'll start by just saying a few lyrics, suddenly the words will start to pour out, and as they do, with them comes this sort of contacting with that other world.
You will not have me in Phoenix Island.
And then maybe a melody will come too, and if I'm lucky, a full song. The ancestors suddenly appear out and around, and a sense of something that is very timeless comes to life, is animated up. Leaving the field, that's into the kitchen. I start to play with the material.
For it's all a young woman, my fortune is hard. And I've been over-courted by a rakish young lad.
I take maybe a sound, or I do a rhythmic pattern. Suddenly I'll pull out a song that's been stewing in my head, that I've been singing, a melody that's been going round, and they'll just unite, like kind of lovers will suddenly connect up.
For if I were a blackbird, I'd whistle, I'd sing. I'd follow the ship that my true love sailed in.
They were meant to be together. This is how, this is where that song, for me, is that curatorship. That's where it needs to be fed and grown and nurtured, and kind of see what noises respond and reflect or don't, or kind of, you know, repel like magnets. There's a song on the album, The Air Dog, and I had this great idea. We were in this kind of shimmering landscape, kind of liminal state where the hair is kind of passing through from one realm to another, from, you know, the land of the living almost to the other side.
Oh, I slept all night in the tinker's arms, tinker's arms around me. Oh, there was folks and there was jokes. Paddy's lost his banjo.
It's like brewing a beer. You've just got to kind of wait till it's ripe, till it's seasoned and it's brewed properly, and then they'll come out. And yeah, I'm adopting children, these sonic children. You spend all your time listening, gathering, and then you go into the creative process. You watch another little seedling has sprouted out, and suddenly that's an idea that you need to go with and explore and nurture. You love things and you record them and you think it's ready and you put it out, and people go, oh God, that awful thing, that awful sound. That's it. I let them out thinking it's ready. It's cooked as far as I'm concerned. That's it. It's like feast time, and you go out hunting and you gather and you store up and then you prepare down and then you feast again.
And she rode home. She made her bed.
Sam Lee's latest album of collected and recast songs is called The Fade in Time. It's now available in the U.S., and you can check out more at samleesong.co.uk. And here's something to take with you today. Forget Jurassic World. evolved only about 518 million years ago in the Cambrian period. If you'd been wandering the shallow seas of China and were barefoot, you've encountered a nasty surprise. Collinsium closium, a creature covered with spikes and named after a Canadian paleontologist, Desmond Collins. Collins conceptualized a similar creature years ago that could have survived in the waters of the Cambrian epoch. He named it Harry Collins Monster, and some beautifully preserved fossils of the bottom feeder confirming the imagined structures have just been found in Yunnan Province in China. Harry Collins joins other bizarre creatures of the Cambrian, the hairy worm Hallucigenia, or Wywaxia, my personal favorite, which is said to be a cross between a lobster and a can opener. A paleontologist actually said that. It was covered with leaves and spikes. Boy, those were the days, half a billion years ago. That's all for today, but you can join the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. And if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.